You remember when scientists first mapped the human genome? The world was amazed at the idea of finally codifying all the genes that create human life. Well, now we've gone a step further. Scientists have actually created the world's first synthetic genome. I'm not talking about a full-on android, but perhaps you could call it an android bacterium. Our science reporter from Cambridge University is Dr. Chris Smith. Chris, hello there.
Morning, Fran.
Now, Chris, this is from the American pioneer in this field, Craig Venter, this synthetic genome. Tell us more.
Yes, this is making headlines all around the world today. It's published in the journal Science, and one of the authors on that paper is indeed genome pioneer Craig Venter, the guy who set up Celera Genomics in the late 90s, which pioneered the shotgun approach to sequencing very rapidly the human genome. One of the long-term goals of Craig Venter and his colleagues has always been to try to come up with a way to produce an artificial life form. And they've moved one step closer to doing that with this publication. And what they have done is to build entirely synthetically a complete genome, in other words, the genetic blueprint, the genetic recipe book that will run a cell for a kind of bacterium. And they have inserted that genome into a foster bacterium, if you like, a new recipient, a different species of bacterium from which the initial genome came that they've copied. And they've
So they're inserting the copy into a real live genome, bacteria.
That's correct. This is a proof of principle, this study. What they wanted to do is show that this is possible. So what they did was to take a genome sequence for a small bacterium. It's actually a species of mycoplasma. It's called Mycoplasma mycoides. This is a very small bacterial species. They took the known published genetic sequence for that. They then rebuilt that genome, making effectively an artificial copy of it. Mm-hmm. So they knew on a computer what the list of DNA letters was in that genome. They then instructed a computer to build an artificial copy, just using chemicals coming out of bottles. You can order bits of DNA from companies and they'll make them for you. That's what they did. They pieced together all the fragments using a combination of yeast cells and E. coli until they had a copy of what nature had already done. And the big challenge was then to make that copy run like software on a computer in a new cell. And so they added that genome to a different mycoplasma, which is called Mycoplasma capricolum, and they put that genome into those cells and it activated and it began to make the cells grow. And after they had grown it for 30 generations, they were able to conclude, well, look, we've made artificial cells, because once you get to 30 generations, 30 splits of each cell, then those cells must only contain chemicals which have been made using the information encoded in the artificial genome they've made. So this is a big step forward because it shows that this, in theory, is possible. You can design and build genomes from scratch. Although they've copied one nature has provided in this instance, they've worked out how to solve the big problems that go with actually getting those genomes into a host cell and then making that cell boot up that DNA software, if you like, to take an analogy, and run it successfully.
So what's the end point you could take from this? How could you extrapolate from this? If you can generate artificial cells, can you build a human? Can you build an elephant? Can you build a tree?
I don't think we're quite there yet, but that's not really the major goal at this stage of synthetic biology. Synthetic biology's goal is to try to take what nature has given us and improve upon it, to solve tractable and tangible problems that face mankind right now. The big problem we face is that there are 6.8 billion people on Earth and rising at an alarming rate. We need food. We're making a mess of the Earth. Just look at what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. And we're also consuming energy at a prodigious rate. In fact, people suggest we're using two planets worth of materials and resources when we only have one planet, of course. So if we can take the solutions that nature has already come up with to solve natural problems and then improve on them, and then produce bespoke organisms that can tackle problems and do it much better than anything else we could do, and in a more energetically favourable and environmentally friendly way, that's got to be a big step forward. So, for instance, you could take algae, which are very good at capturing energy from the sun, and you could improve by tinkering with the systems they've got on their ability to capture energy from the sun and make them far more efficient photosynthesizers, and they would make, say, hydrogen, which we could produce, which we could then put into cars or put into other feedstocks for refining and so on.
Incredible. Chris, from bacteria to outer space, talking of the sun, scientists have identified another way that stars kill themselves. And get this, it might have something to do with the calcium in our bones. What's the link?
Well, we're all actually children of stars, as one pop star put it in the past. All of the heavy elements and all of the complex elements in the human body, in fact all life on Earth, has actually come from stars, either during the course of the star burning its hydrogen fuel and fusing it to make bigger and bigger elements, or when those stars blow themselves up. And calcium is one classic example that seems to have had its origins put under the microscope this week, or put under a big telescope, you could say. There's a paper in Nature this week, which is by, there's two papers, in fact, by researchers both in America and also in Israel, and they've been looking at how stars destroy themselves at the end of their lives, supernovae. Now, we were quite comfortable with the idea that stars blow up at the end of their lives, and we've defined two ways they can do that, so-called type 1a supernovae, which are what are called white dwarf stars. These are fairly old, mature stars, and various processes happen that lead to the outer part of the star blowing up in a big thermonuclear explosion. And because these stars contain lots of carbon and oxygen, they blast that out into space. We've seen that. We can see that happening. Researchers have documented it. There's also a second type of supernova called a type 2 supernova, where massive stars, which can be, in some cases, up to 120 times the size of our own sun, blast themselves to pieces, and they eject a very different pattern of material out into space. But when researchers began to look at a supernova that appeared, first of all, in 2005, it was called SN2005E, they noticed that something was wrong. This supernova was a star that blew itself up 110 million years ago. That's how far away it is, because the light has been coming to us ever since. And when they looked in that light, written into it is a really interesting signature, because it showed lots of titanium, but also lots of calcium. And this does not fit with any of our previous models of how stars end their lives in these catastrophic supernovae. And so the researchers have had to rethink their model a bit, and this suggests that there is a third way that stars can die, and they're just beginning to probe how that might happen. But if you look how much calcium there is floating around us and on this planet, just for starters, this shows that actually this method of star death is probably a lot more complicated, a lot more common, rather, than we first thought.
The death of stars. Chris, it's great to talk to you. Talk to you next Friday with some more scientific breakthroughs. Thank you.
Thanks, Fran.
Chris Smith, our science editor there, joining us from Cambridge in the UK. It's 17 to 7.